Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Rachel Wright, and at 14 hours GMT on the 3rd of November 2023, these are our main stories. The US Secretary of State Antony Blinken urges Israel to protect Palestinian civilians. The leader of Hezbollah has been making his first public statement about the Hamas attacks of October the 7th. And the UN says more than 25,000 people have been displaced by the upsurge in fighting in Myanmar. Also in this podcast, concern about immigration bolsters support for Germany's far-right party. And
Colombia is a heaven for them. We have plenty of water all year round. You have a lot of grass for them to eat. They did very well.
The latest on the escapee hippos from the zoo of drug kingpin Pablo Escobar. The leader of the Iranian-backed Hezbollah movement in Lebanon has praised Hamas for its assault on Israel last month, in which about 1,400 people, most of them civilians, were killed. In his first public comments on the conflict, Hassan Nasrallah described the actions of Hamas as right, wise and just. Hezbollah, which, like Hamas, is considered a terrorist organization by the US and other Western countries, is the biggest political and military force in Lebanon. And it's already clashed with Israeli troops on the border. Hundreds of supporters gathered in a public square in Beirut to watch Nasrallah's video address. Our correspondent, Yolande Nell, who's in Jerusalem, was watching.
This is a big crowd of support for Hassan Nasrallah as he gives a speech. There are people with the Palestinian flag, with Lebanese flags, the flags of Hezbollah itself, all gathered to listen to this speech. And I actually have to say, talking to colleagues around the region, they have told me that because this really does have a potentially very big impact, it's extremely quiet in many Arab towns and cities as people tune in to hear what Hassan Nasrallah says. I mean, he started off quite slowly with lots of flowery language, and he's talking about what he calls the martyrs of Lebanon and Palestinians. He sends his condolences and blessings also to those who have been killed in Gaza and in the West Bank. He talked about what happened on the 7th of October directly. Lots of accusations have been made that Iran had a leading role in it, but he was clear. He's representing a group, of course, which is very close to Iran, and he said that it was an 100% Palestinian initiative, and he praised it in that sense. Now, he said that this was something that had happened in the context of 75 years of the Palestinian people being under occupation, of course, 75 years since the creation of the State of Israel. He talked about the suffering the Palestinians had been through. Very much he's talking only about the Palestinian question in his speech. He said other issues related to Lebanon would have to wait. But what we don't have at this moment is any clue about what could be the Lebanese group's involvement, you know, how much it might step up its own attacks on Israel. Up to now, what we've seen is kind of more tit-for-tat exchanges, although they have escalated in recent days across the border. We haven't seen Hezbollah using its longer-range missiles. Experts believe that the group has more than 100,000 missiles, some of them really quite precise ones that could potentially be used to try to reach all of Israel and key infrastructure if this war was to escalate on this second front across Israel's northern border with Lebanon.
Yolande Nell. The US Secretary of State Antony Blinken is in Israel again on his second visit to the region in less than a month. He said humanitarian pauses in the fighting in Gaza were an important part of his discussions with Israeli leaders. The Hamas-run health ministry says more than 9,000 people have died in Gaza since the 7th of October. At a news conference, Antony Blinken said that Israel had Washington's full support to defend itself.
I've returned to the region to engage in intense diplomacy with our partners to try to help ensure that an attack like October 7th never happens again. And in doing so, that we forge a different future, a very different future for Israelis and Palestinians alike. That out of this tragedy emerges a better tomorrow for both peoples and for the region.
Before leaving Washington, Mr. Blinken said Israel must ensure Gaza's civilians are protected, comments he repeated today with Israeli President Isaac Herzog. Here's what Mr. Herzog had to say about the steps being taken to warn innocent Palestinians of its upcoming attacks.
We are sending back over 1,200,000 leaflets to the citizens of Gaza. We've carried out 6 million text messages and 4 million phone calls to the citizens of Gaza according to the rules of international law, where we alerted the citizens in advance, including before the Jabalia attack. Please move out, because as we have the right for self-defense, we want you to go out.
The Hamas-run health ministry in the Gaza Strip says more than 9,000 people have died there since the October the 7th attacks on Israel. Our correspondent, Anna Foster, told me more about Mr. Blinken's latest trip to the Middle East, starting with his calls for a pause in fighting to allow aid to reach Gaza.
Still, even now, the amount of aid trucks that are passing through the Rafah crossing from Egypt into Gaza are far smaller, far lower than they would need to be to actually meet the needs of the civilian population, many of whom find themselves displaced there at the moment.
And what do we know about what the Israeli Defence Force is saying happened in fighting overnight?
Well, what they're saying now is that they have encircled Gaza City, which is something strategically important because that is very much where Hamas's centre is in Gaza. A lot of their command and control infrastructure, some of their very senior operational commanders are based in Gaza City. And we've heard from the IDF that their troops on the ground, their armoured vehicles, are all the time targeting and eliminating, they say, terrorist cells. The question is, I think, now how long this phase of the operation will take. The Israelis have said throughout that this will be a long and difficult war. We don't know how quickly the Israel Defense Forces will be able to achieve this stated aim of removing Hamas from Gaza.
And what do you make of the IDF claim that they eliminated a Hamas battalion commander overnight?
Well, for the last few days, they have been talking about killing these senior Hamas leaders, and it is something they have been using in justification for the civilian death toll in some of these attacks and some of these airstrikes that we've seen. We know that UNRWA, the UN agency that looks after Palestinian refugees, have said that in the last 24 hours, four of their schools have been hit where people are sheltering. Now, Israel has made it very clear. They say that Hamas is using Palestinian civilians in Gaza as human shields. And they say that because they are taking out these senior Hamas commanders, that is their justification for targeting these particular areas. Of course, Hamas's most senior leaders, several of them are out of the country altogether. But Israel is really giving this impression through its regular updates that they are managing to chip away at Hamas's infrastructure within Gaza.
And then, of course, the Rafah crossing, the key vital lifeline between Gaza and Egypt. Has it reopened today? And if so, is it busy?
It appears to be open again for a third day. There's been a fresh list of people that have been published, around 600 or so, we think, who will be given permission to leave today. Now, it is important to remember that these are all people who have dual nationalities or foreign passports. Around 7,500 of them over 2 weeks, the Egyptians have said, will be given permission to pass through the Rafah crossing from Gaza into Egypt. On the day that their name appears on the list, that will give them passage through the crossing. But of course, that is only a very, very tiny fraction of the more than 2 million civilians who remain inside Gaza without the opportunity or the means to leave as this war goes on.
Anna Foster. Now, there's probably no American diplomat who knows more about the Middle East than Dennis Ross. As special envoy, he was one of Washington's key Middle East negotiators in the Oslo peace process, the closest that the Israelis and Palestinians have perhaps come to a peace agreement. He's also served under Presidents George Bush Sr. and Barack Obama. My colleague Victoria Uwankunda asked him what he thought Antony Blinken is hoping to achieve during his latest trip to a troubled region.
I think the thrust will be on trying to understand the combination of where the military strategy is right now, what it has achieved, how it relates to the ultimate objectives of destroying the Hamas military infrastructure and also the political command control so that Hamas can't be the ruler of Gaza when this is over, but also how does one in this at the same time, how does one create enough safe areas and enough corridors so that the Palestinian the civilian population with in Gaza can be have their needs addressed in circumstances that are obviously profoundly difficult.
Can Hamas be defeated and eradicated without, you know, killing the, seeing more loss of civilian lives?
Well, I think the term eradication is probably one that shouldn't be used. And I say that because not every single person who identifies with Hamas or every single person who may be a member of Hamas is going to disappear, going to be destroyed, going to be killed. What I think the objective is to destroy the very significant military infrastructure, much of the tunnel system, which protects Hamas fighters and leaders, but not the Palestinian public. It is ironic that 300 square miles of tunnels have been built underground at enormous expense, but they're not for any Palestinian civilians. I think that's, you're looking at that, you're looking at getting the leadership. You're not talking about the eradication of Hamas. You're talking about weakening Hamas to the position where someone else, in some kind of international administration on an interim basis, can be established with the support of the international community, with the support of leading Arab states who likely have a stake in coming in to help rescue Palestinians from what Hamas has subjected them to. So I think that's the way to think about it. Now, you ask the question, can it be done with no civilian casualties? And obviously, sadly, no. Tragically, no, because Hamas has so embedded itself in civilian areas and basically holds its population hostage, not just the hostages it has taken.
Do you think that there is a way forward, looking maybe through diplomatic process?
Look, there clearly are a range of different kinds of options that can be pursued even now. One could be the idea of the Hamas leadership leaves, they release all the hostages, they leave Gaza, an international trusteeship effectively is established, a UN mandate is created for that, you allow Palestinian technocrats to help manage that civil administration. You get Arab and non-Arab forces to come in to provide security. You create a structure for massive reconstruction. You create a future for Gaza where it's completely demilitarized and in return for a massive reconstruction program. There's a pathway here. It's hard to pursue it so long as Hamas remains in control of Gaza. If Hamas is no longer in control of Gaza, then all sorts of possibilities, I think, avail themselves, and active diplomacy can help us get there.
Former Middle East envoy Dennis Ross. Now, the United Nations says more than 25,000 people have been displaced across Myanmar by intense fighting between the ruling military and ethnic insurgents in the northeast. Last week, an alliance of three rebel groups launched a military operation in Myanmar's northern Shan state. Jonathan Head reports.
More than a week after the ethnic insurgents began their attack over a wide area of northern Shan state, the Myanmar military has been unable to mount an effective response. With many of its troops killed or forced to surrender, it's relied on airstrikes and artillery, forcing thousands to leave their homes. But it's been unable to stop the insurgents from overrunning dozens of positions and cutting the two main roads to the border with China, through which half of the country's overland trade passes. This is the most serious military setback suffered by the junta, which seized power 2.5 years ago. It's been inflicted by ethnic armies, which until now had largely stayed out of the wider conflict between the military and a broad-based opposition movement. The insurgents say they now share the goal of overthrowing the military government. In this operation, they've been supported by hundreds of volunteer fighters from other parts of Myanmar. They also say they want to shut down the scam centres, which have proliferated along the border, in which thousands of foreign nationals have been held and forced to work. The government of Thailand says it's trying to rescue around 160 of its own citizens who were in one of these centres and are now trapped in a town which is being besieged by the insurgents.
Jonathan Head. Still to come on this podcast, a high-profile trial ends with a conviction. Worrying news for the future from one of the world's richest men. But before we move on, let's get news of this weekend's Happy Pod with Andrew Peach.
Yes, there's a musical theme this week with a Ukrainian refugee who wrote a piece of music to cheer up a colleague, which then went viral. Also, the band that walked between scores of their gigs carrying their instruments on their backs. There's news from Brazil of a vaccine for cocaine addiction, a new type of seal in Greenland, and two incredible young people, a six-year-old girl in China who can do a Rubik's Cube in 6 seconds, and a 17-year-old robotics expert from India who could transform the lives of people with Parkinson's disease. Join me, Andrew Peach, for half an hour of uplifting news in the Happy Pod in this feed every Saturday.
Now, artificial intelligence, or AI, is meant to make our lives better and easier. On Thursday, the entrepreneur Elon Musk said he could see a time when people no longer had to work because AI would do all the jobs.
There will come a point where no job is needed. You can have a job if you want to have a job for sort of personal satisfaction, but the AI will be able to do everything.
But experts have warned that while millions of people are benefiting from it, others are losing out because they don't speak English. They say most AI systems, which are designed in Western countries and are biased towards the English language, don't take into account other languages and cultures. Our correspondent, Joe Tidy, told me more.
Well, AI is trained on open information that's usually found on the internet. A computer program will take in every single piece of data it can. And the internet is largely English language written. That means that the models that are made in AI, particularly the likes of ChatGPT and Bard and Lambda, they are tools that allow you to put a question in and get a response that's usually very human-like and sometimes quite accurate. But of course, if the data that's going in is mainly English language, that means what you're getting out is going to be leaning heavily towards English language resources and information. And because of that, there's been lots of studies that have been done saying that if you're a non-English speaker, you are getting a worse product.
And of course, it means that this information fails to reflect other languages and cultures.
Yeah, that's right. There was a recent study done by a machine learning scientist called Yenny Jen, and she put in 16 different languages math problems. And she found that if you ask in English language, then you're likely to get answers that are three times more accurate than other answers. And then there are other languages that are what we call well-resourced as well. So there's lots of information and data, for example, German or Spanish. But if you go down the list of how well-resourced the language is, so for example, Amharic or Burmese, the answers you're getting to these math problems are either complete nonsense or they just simply cannot do them.
Is it because most of technology and technology companies are based in the United States that this has happened?
It's definitely a contributing factor, but the main problem here is the lack of other languages on the internet. Although English language is only spoken by about 16% of the population, about 65% of the websites out there is in English. And English is described as an extremely high resource language. Then you've got other ones which are high resource, so Chinese, Japanese, Spanish, German, French, and Russian and Arabic. They are well resourced. So even if you had a company that wasn't in Silicon Valley, you'd be able to make a large language model that's pretty good. But when you go down the list, all the way down to, say, Zulu or Haitian Creole or Swahili, you just simply can't make a large language model that's going to be as effective and as economical as you can if you're building in English. There's also the argument, and this was put out by the Center of Democracy and Technology, that there just isn't the incentive. If you're a Silicon Valley company, all the money is in the Western world and Northern Hemisphere, so you wouldn't necessarily try and make your large language models effective and better for other people who don't speak English.
It is for now, but we all know that big countries like India and China are looking to dominate in the future. So are they doing anything to change this?
Yeah, and I think it's really interesting. We're seeing this race around the world because people are kind of waking up to this, and governments are waking up to the fact that the models from Silicon Valley just aren't cutting the mustard. So they're building their own. China has got already a huge, really successful tech sector, and they've worked very hard to build their own Chinese language first AI models, and that's going very well for them. India has got a big problem because India is, as you say, a growing power in the world, but they've got dozens of languages, and there is this really, really poor resourcing of the information on the internet. So what we're seeing is some interesting initiatives like the Bhashadan initiative, where they're asking people to volunteer to use their own language skills to translate bits of text or bits of podcasts, to try and build up that database of different Indian languages to help them build their own AI systems from that. But it's a mountain to climb because, of course, there's just such a difference in resourcing when you've got something like English, which is just absolutely everywhere.
I was speaking to Joe Tidy. He was once called the king of crypto, but last night in New York, Sam Bankman-Fried was found guilty of fraud and money laundering. For more insight, this time yesterday on Global News Podcast, we brought you an interview with Michael Lewis, who's written a book on the young entrepreneur who founded the cryptocurrency exchange FTX. A few hours later, Bankman-Fried has been convicted on 7 counts. It follows a 5-week trial that dug deep into how one of the biggest crypto exchanges and its sister trading company collapsed about a year ago. The US attorney for the Southern District of New York, Damian Williams, gave this statement to reporters after the verdict.
Sam Bankman-Fried perpetrated one of the biggest financial frauds in American history. A multi-billion dollar scheme designed to make him the king of crypto. Here's the thing. The cryptocurrency industry might be new. The players like Sam Bankman-Fried might be new. But this kind of fraud, this kind of corruption is as old as time. And we have no patience for it.
Our business correspondent, Erin Delmore in New York, told my colleague Charlotte Gallagher more about him.
Sam Bankman-Fried was the founder of FTX, which became the world's second largest crypto exchange, a trading platform where people could change their regular dollars and pounds into cryptocurrencies and trade them. He also founded an investment fund called Alameda Research, and he was wealthy. His net worth was up to $26 billion. Right now, he's only age 31. He was on the cover of magazines, he was hobnobbing with celebrities, and getting them to endorse his deals and advertisements and his companies and advertisements. And then his cryptocurrency company, the exchange, and the hedge fund collapsed in the fall of 2002, and thousands of XTF customers were left without billions of dollars.
And he's been found guilty in court. He's always protested his innocence, but he's been found guilty.
Yep, he maintained his innocence throughout this trial, pleading not guilty to all 7 charges. The jury returned guilty verdicts on all 7. And the prosecution framed it to the jury as Sam Bankman-Fried is guilty of stealing customer funds and of spending the money on investments and real estate purchases and political donations and to pay back lenders to his crypto hedge fund, Alameda Research. And he's also lied to investors and to lenders. These are the charges that he was found guilty of today.
And this case has rocked the cryptocurrency world because people who are into crypto are really into it, aren't they?
And may have lost money. Mm. Remember, there were thousands of people who traded on FTX, and when FTX went bankrupt, it did not have customer funds safeguarded. That's at the heart of the story here, that customers lost the money that they entrusted to FTX and that they had told through the terms of service were protected. And yes, it did rock the industry. Cryptocurrency soared to heights in 2021 and then fell in 2022. And we have seen here calls for more regulation in the crypto industry. And that's something that we expect to hear more of now that this trial has concluded.
What kind of sentence would you expect for this sort of crime?
We'll find out exactly on March 28th. That's when the judge has set the sentencing hearing date. But Sam Bankman-Fried faces decades in prison and potentially a lifetime sentence. He's been found guilty on all 7 charges, and the statutory maximum for 5 of those charges are 20 years each. For the other 2, 5 years. That's a maximum of 110 years in prison. We do expect the judge to come in below that. Judges often come in below the statutory maximum, but that's a life sentence.
Erin Delmore speaking to my colleague Charlotte Gallagher. People traffickers face tougher sentences as part of a crackdown on illegal migration under new proposals put forward by the German government. The tough line follows gains by the far-right AfD, Alternative for Deutschland Party, in regional elections. Our Berlin correspondent, Jessica Parker, reports from the eastern state of Saxony.
Hello, Federal Police, Border Control.
Just inside Germany, police are looking for something.
Can you open the trunk for me?
It's the hunt for human traffickers and their desperate cargo.
You can close it.
The number of people caught entering Germany illegally this year is set to be the highest since 2016. 2 hours west, we're on Saxony's southern border with the Czech Republic. On a rainy Tuesday night, 40 to 50 locals have gathered in Hermsdorf village square. Speakers voice anger that nearby apartments might be used to house migrants. Anya is in the group.
For me, the young migrants who come here, they are armies. I feel so powerless. We as a people are the solution, but we need the rest to wake up too.
Just 10 minutes from Hermsdorf, the pull of Germany is strong.
I get my hiking bag, I cross the river and I start the trip.
Mohammed Abdoum lives in an old youth hostel with around 50 other Syrians. Mohammed has successfully sought asylum. Men like him come here to build a life, he says, not detract from the lives of others.
Everyone here have a dream coming here. Everyone, he's dreaming about his children, about a safe place to make really family.
Are you okay?
I'm okay. I lost too much friends. I lost my age.
Mohammed left Syria nearly a decade ago before making his way through Turkey, the Balkans and other EU countries. He's an energetic man, but clearly also tired. Up the road, families race down a toboggan ride in Altenburg town. It looks idyllic, but the local mayor from the Christian Democrat Party is uneasy. New arrivals put a strain on services, Markus Wiesenberg says, while the people smugglers keep getting through.
Stellenweise 50 Leuten am Tag auf einer ganz kleinen Stück Landkarte in Sachsen.
Sometimes 50 migrants a day in this small spot on the map. That concerns people. Occasionally, they find sleeping bags and campfires in the woods, and they're worried for their children.
Sorge um ihre Kinder.
Are you worried that this issue will drive more voters, more people towards AfD, Alternative for Deutschland?
Yeah. Grundlegend, yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
Alternative for Deutschland, the far-right anti-immigration party that's polling ahead of the three governing parties. Migration has, of course, sparked furious debate here before. Remember in 2015 when Angela Merkel allowed in 1 million people. Germany's still absorbing big numbers. It's taken more than 1 million Ukrainians. And it's actively trying to attract skilled foreign workers because of acute labour shortages. But it's the rise in uncontrolled illegal migration that's causing Berlin and the EU a huge political headache.
Jess Parker reporting. Now, if you had to ponder the environmental problems facing Latin America, wild hippos would probably not come instantly to mind. And yet, the government of Colombia has been trying for years to contain its own hippo population, most recently announcing a cull. And it all started with the drugs kingpin Pablo Escobar. The newsroom's Peter Goffin reports.
Pablo Escobar built a billion-dollar empire of crime and bloodshed in the 1980s and 90s. His Medellin cartel was, at one time, the world's biggest supplier of cocaine, and its members are believed to have murdered more than 4,000 people. But Escobar fancied himself a hero of Colombia's working classes. At his luxury ranch, he built a kind of theme park and zoo, where, for free, members of the public could see elephants, giraffes, rhinos, and hippos. When Escobar was killed in a shootout with police in 1993, his assets, including the menagerie, were seized by the authorities, but not before some of the hippos escaped.
They move a lot, and they use the rivers as highways, so they could move kilometers in one day.
Carlos Valderrama is a vet who grew up nearby. He spoke to the BBC last year.
Colombia is a heaven for them. We have plenty of water all year round. You have a lot of grass for them to eat. They did very well.
By the 2000s, people were reporting strange, hulking creatures in and around the Magdalena River, one of Colombia's main waterways. Dr. Valderrama was called in to sterilize one of the hippos about 12 years ago. Another one was killed after it became aggressive. Now, with 166 hippos roaming wild, Colombia says it's launching a cull. Some of the animals will be euthanized, others sterilized, and some will be offered to other countries. Hippos are considered one of the deadliest animals in the world. In their native Africa, they kill hundreds of people each year. For Dr. Valderrama, their presence in Colombia is just another part of Escobar's brutal legacy.
This is one of many problems that he left us. Unfortunately, I have to live through his time. It was a very difficult time for us.
The newsroom's Peter Goffin on the plight of the Colombian hippos. And I certainly wouldn't mess with them. One of them once took a bite out of my boat. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Joe McCartney. The producer was Lipika Pelham. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Rachel Wright. Until next time, goodbye.